Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 296. How can you avoid schema problems in your Polar's data pipeline when adding new columns? And how can you quickly examine a GitHub user's profile to decide how much to invest in their contributions? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher shares a recent article about handling schema issues in Python Polar's. The piece covers ways that a schema change can break your data pipeline. It provides strategies to avoid and resolve issues. We cover a recent project from previous guest Eric Mathis to investigate GitHub profiles of a potential contributor. With the rise of AI slop pull requests, the tool can provide valuable background on the user. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including recent releases, exploring four different get special methods, what's new in PIP 26.1, inverse Sapir Whorf and programming languages, and a Python scripting framework for CAD. This episode is brought to you by 6 Feet Up, the Python and AI experts who solve hard software problems. Whether it's scaling an application, deriving insights from data, or getting results from AI, 6 Feet Up helps you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
It must be springtime in Canada, based upon your background. Of course, for audio listeners, they're not going to catch this.
I'm mid-reno and ashamed of what my office looks like. I don't actually usually like the video overlay thing. The jankiness in the shoulders on other people always bothers me. I start getting distracted looking at the artifacts, and so I don't usually use it, but... yeah, it's that or I look like I live in a van down by the river. So we're going with green. There we go.
All right. Well, we got our usual lineup of news, topics, and projects this week. You ready to dig in?
Sure. Let's do this.
All right.
In the words of Seth Meyers, I hope you're doing well. And now, if you don't mind, we're going to get to the news. So... starting off with some releases in the CPython space, Python 3.14.5 came out. This one had a bit more fuss than most point releases, as it removes the incremental garbage collector, which was having some issues in certain production environments. Next is Python 3.15 Beta 1.
Yay!
Yep, feature freeze has started. So what's there now is what's intended for October. And there's a whole bunch of peps that now have the word deferred next to them because there's some things right. We just didn't get around to. CPython's cousin, PyPy, had a release as well. 7.3.22 is a bug fix release, including squishing several long-standing issues with the JIT. Next, Django released versions 6.0.5 and 5.2.14, which addresses three security issues, including a potential denial of service vulnerability in how ASGI deals with file uploads. So if you do your async stuff, maybe you want a patch there.
All right.
On the topic of Django, the Django Developer Survey is up, once again sponsored by JetBrains. If you use Django, tell the good folks at the DSF about how you use it. These surveys are interesting in their own right, but they also help guide where future development focuses. Loads of AI questions in this one. Not terribly surprising, that. And last up is two PEPs. These are both things that were originally slotted for 3.15, but are being deferred to 3.16. PEP 797, titled Shared Object Proxies, proposes a way of sharing Python objects across concurrent interpreters. And the other one that got shifted is PEP 828, titled Supporting Yield From in Asynchronous Generators. Python's yield keyword is used in generator functions, which allow you to produce a single value at a time instead of returning a collection, like, say, a list. So, for example, if you were generating the first 100 Fibonacci numbers, instead of returning a list with that in it, you could yield each value and then use that function as an iterable. Sometimes you want a generator in your generator, so rather than looping over the inner generator and yielding each item, you can yield from the inner generator, and Python iterates the results for you to the outer function. So that's the first half of the title. Second half has the scary word asynchronous in it. And essentially tying all this together, PEP 828 proposes mechanisms to allow yield from to work with asynchronous generators, essentially letting you tack the async keyword in front of yield from, allowing that outer function to operate concurrently.
All right.
Seeing as I opened with a Seth Meyers quote, should I pass it to you to take a closer look? Depending on the Venn diagram of his audience and ours, there's a chance only you and I will understand that reference. But, you know, being oblique entertains me, so it's all yours.
Yeah. Well, the tutorial I'm going to start with is by frequent guest and friend of the show, Stephen Grupetta. It's on his The Python Coding Stack site. The title is, Do You Get It Now? It digs into four special methods, aka dunder methods, with git in their name. Dunder git item, dunder git adder, or A-T-T-R, dunder git attribute, and dunder get. It starts with, you think, aren't they all the same thing? They're all getting stuff, right? Yes, they are getting stuff, but the way each works is different. So this is a journey, and I'm going to say that multiple times as I go through this. It's one of the longer pieces that Stephen's written on his site. And you might have seen these dunder methods if you've run like the dir function on an object. Maybe you're looking at other people's code and you're trying to figure out, well, what are the methods and things that this supports? So you might have like wondered, well, boy, there's a whole bunch of git things here and how are they different? And I like it. It's a really nice deep dive into object-oriented Python, which Stephen has been really teaching regularly now at Real Python in his intermediate deep dive live courses. I want to note, much of the tutorial assumes you know a bit about OOP in Python and uses a bunch of tactics that most developers would not typically approach. He's doing things by design to take you through this journey of discovery, often kind of through overriding behavior. I'm not going to dig too deep into the code examples because it is a long piece, but they're very useful. And I think that it's useful to code along with it to kind of see what's happening. All of this is by design. So as you reason through the flow, you're using the print function to point out the paths the code takes. And he starts with get item, which he finds to be the least challenging to explain. It works through square bracket notation. So you would put that after the object's name to access an item. You're using this to get an item out of a list or a dictionary, some sort of data structure. So he creates an example class with a data structure in it, in this case, a dictionary of names as keys and numbers as values, maybe their ages. The first time you try to access it, creating an instance of the class, and you test it out, you put instance name and then square brackets, and then in this case, mark, it pops out a type error. Object is not subscriptable. It includes a dictionary as a data attribute inside of it, but the object itself is not subscriptible, which means you can't use the square bracket notation to fetch an item. So back to defining the class and implementing dunder get item, the special method we were talking about before, and he sets it up so you have it return an item from the dictionary. The piece shows some more of the complexity if you try to give more than one item in the square brackets. What happens? Like I said, it's a real journey. Next, what you might have used more often with classes is dot notation. Dot notation is used in a variety of ways to access attributes. In this particular case, it has the same code, but what if you just put dot and then the item that you want using before in the square brackets, using the dot and then the name? So in this particular case, you get an attribute error. Object has no attribute, in this case, calling the name Mark, the name you tried to get out of it. If you've been through an introductory course on object-oriented programming in Python, attributes are the things that you can access using dot notation. data attributes, methods, properties, and other things that you can use via that style of using dot notation. So this is, again, where I caution the code takes you through. I would argue you probably wouldn't write code like this. So he implements get attr, or get adder, I think is how most people pronounce it. You can guess that this special method name stands for get attribute, but it's not the only special method that is named get attribute. There's actually one truly named dunder get attribute. So he has it grab the value based on the name provided in the dictionary. Again, you might have used dot notation to get an attribute's value, something that isn't a data collection, list, or dictionary. So this requires a little bit of extra code. So he continues to show how this is all set up. Like I said, it's a nice journey. Conditions to show you how get attribute, dunder get attribute, is different from dunder get adder. And he goes through working with implementing code to troubleshoot and show you how it works at this deeper level. Dunder get attribute works at a much deeper level than get adder. He has a section on the asymmetry between dunder get adder and dunder set adder. And then he wraps up with dunder get, which is unique to all of them. In fact, it requires a bit of more reading. Some background will be needed in, as he calls it, the weird and wonderful world of descriptors in Python, which he's written a very detailed piece on. And I'll include a link for that also. All in all, it's a good exploration. And I like it as a way to explain through trial and error. And I think that works really well with object-oriented programming, for you to try this stuff out, have mistakes happen, have things get named, using print to sort of debug things often. In this case, you're overriding things, which I think is also kind of unique, and learning a little bit about how object-oriented code operates. As a final note, he lands a solid dad joke at the end of the piece that made his son walk out of the room. So good job. Thanks, Steven. This episode of the Real Python Podcast is brought to you by 6 Feet Up. What's stopping you? Maybe it's an application that won't scale, or an AI initiative that just isn't delivering. That's where 6 Feet Up comes in. With deep expertise in Python and AI, they solve hard software problems, modernize platforms, and get teams to market faster. Their impact speaks for itself, automating healthcare pipelines, helping NASA explore Pluto, building severe weather prediction tools, and applying AI to connect farmers with vital crop data. When the stakes are high and the problems are hard, 6 Feet Up is the partner that delivers. See what's possible at 6feetup.com. What's your first one here?
My first article this week is from the Polar's blog, and it's by Thijs Nieuwdorp. Thijs, if you're listening, I looked up how to pronounce your name on YouTube, so hopefully I got it close enough. Complete tangent, but why does it take a 40-second video to explain how to pronounce a name? I believe I know the answer. It's the algorithm. Where was I? Yes. So Thijs wrote an article titled Handling Schema Issues in Polars. For those not familiar, Polars is a data frame library that tackles similar data science problems to pandas. And at risk of heading down an explanational spiral, data frames are a way of containing row and column data in memory. So you can think of it like a spreadsheet object in RAM. And RAM, no, I'll stop. Polars supports many different data formats which you can load into a data frame. Some data formats are very specific about the data types of each column, and others are not. A Polars data frame column has a type, so unlike Excel, you can't be all willy-nilly about the contents. If you're using Polars interactively to solve a problem, you can see what data type it thinks the column is and make changes if that's not what you wanted. A common data format is CSV files, which have no data type information inside of them. When you load a CSV into Polars, it examines the first 100 rows and uses that data to guess at the type for each column. So say you've got a column filled with integers. If row 101 has a float in it, you're going to get an error. You can explicitly tell Polars what type to cast a column to in order to get around this problem. Of course, if you're doing all of this interactively, that just kind of becomes part of cleaning your data up, which is a big part of data science. Where this gets messy is with data pipelines. So let's say you have a process that runs once a day that ingests data from upstream and then goes and does some processing on it. changes upstream could cause your code to fail. For example, all of a sudden upstream starts using floats instead of integers, and your assumptions are wrong. Ty's article talks about how these kinds of schema changes impact your data pipeline. He breaks it down into four things that can affect your data. First is additive, someone adding a new column. Second is subtractive, someone getting rid of a column. Third is type drift, which is the example I used before, where the data type changes. And last is breaking, which is his catch-all for changes like a column being renamed that you usually can't do very much about. Depending on your file format, you can automatically deal with some of these problems. For example, adding a column may not affect your data at all. A CSV file may or may not have a header row. If it does, Polars is smart enough to use the header name, and so inserting a column or changing their order doesn't really affect anything. Likewise with subtraction. If the column that got subtracted isn't one your process uses, then no biggie. Of course, without that header row, all of this falls apart because column order becomes important. The read and write methods for a file format may help you as well. That schema inference mechanism for CSVs that guesses the type of data based on the first 100 rows can be turned off by setting inference schema to false. In that case, each column is imported as a string instead, and then your code is responsible for casting it to the types that you want. So for example, if your column mixes ints and floats and decimals and you want decimals, you could force that yourself regardless of the contents of the first 100 rows. I'm not going to go into super detail here, but Ty's article goes over four common sources of data: CSV, Parquet, Delta Lake, and Apache Iceberg, and then discusses how to handle each of the four schema change types for each of those formats. You may not always be in control of the upstream data, but if you are, the correct choice for file format can make your life an awful lot easier. There's some good advice here from Ty's. I've actually added the Polars blog to my RSS feed, so it looks like there's plenty of good stuff here. I'm looking forward to reading some more.
I had Thijs and Jeroen on the show in episode 260. They were on to discuss their Polars book. The title episode was Harnessing the Power of Python Polars. So if you want to dig a little bit further in, yeah, he does good stuff. My next one is titled What's New in PIP 26.1. We've been talking about how UV compares to PIP in a lot of ways. We've had a couple different pieces. In fact, episode 280, Considering Fast and Slow in Python Programming, we talked about, there was an article inside there about how Rust isn't the only reason that UV is fast. It's actually doing a lot of other things under the hood and kind of getting around some of the problems with the legacy of packaging, if you will. It's fun to watch this blog kind of continue that trend to see PIP continue to improve and have it work through some of these new PEPs and other things that have been introduced. And so that's what this is about. This piece is on Richard Tsai's site, his last name, S-I. Starting in 2024, he's been a co-maintainer for PIP. The article is titled, What's New in PIP 26.1, Lock Files and Dependency Cooldowns. First item that he covers in this list of stuff is Python 3.9 is no longer supported by PIP 26.1. It now targets 3.10 and higher. Python 3.9 entered end-of-life status 6 months ago, October 2025. This is the point in the year many of PIP's vendor dependencies have stopped supporting Python 3.9. So it made sense for PIP to drop support as well. The next thing in the list is something we've mentioned before, a new feature of installing from pylock.toml files. After a year since the acceptance of PEP 751, which standardized the pylock.toml lock files, PIP 26.1 gains experimental support for reading and installing from such lock files. Use pip install-r pylock.toml. It will provide a nice warning. Using pylock.toml as requirements source is an experimental feature. So they're continuing to work on this. The piece covers some of the edge cases that are reasons why it's still experimental. One is by default, PIP will let requirements from lock files pull in additional non-locked requirements. So you'd have to pass dash dash no DEPS if this is undesirable. So if you don't want it to pull in non-locked requirements. The requirements sourced from a lock file are treated specially. They function like pinned requirements where the used archive or path is pre-constrained. If hashes are available for a locked requirement, pip will validate hashes as expected. And another warning that is, again, it's experimental at the moment, should not be considered production ready, but they are working to refine and would like more real-world experience and feedback. There's a call out for that. So if you're interested in seeing pip continue to progress toward having the lock file format a little more solidly inside there, this is a way for you to add some feedback. The next one seems to be perpetually timely. Dependency cooldowns. So there's a flag, --uploaded-prior-2. So uploaded prior to now supports or accepts a relative duration in P lowercase n d format where n is the number of days. So it's meant to enable dependency cooldowns, which aim to reduce the impact of compromised upstream packages. So it might look like something like pip install, the long phrase again, --uploaded-prior-2=P3D. So in this case, that would be a dependency cooldown for anything that has been uploaded in the last 3 days. So you're like skipping the last 3 days of potential updates. Dependency cooldown involves configuring a set period of time before a newly released package is eligible for installation, providing time for package registries and third-party security firms to discover and package authors to recover, possibly from a compromise. So it's worth noting that while a cooldown can minimize the impact of supply chain attacks, it will also delay security fixes from reaching your environment. He provides a link to a post by William Woodruff. It's titled, "We Should All Be Using Dependency Cooldowns." So if you'd like to learn a little bit more about that, I think it's an interesting possible way of dealing with these types of supply chain attacks or other potential malformed packages getting into your system. The last section is about lifting several of the 2020 resolver limitations. The modern pip resolver, the 2020 resolver, which is kind of wild. We talked about on the show in episode 29, titled Resolving Package Dependencies with the New Version of pip. Had a couple people from the pip team come and talk. This new resolver is miles better than the legacy resolver, capable of resolving complex dependency trees without producing an invalid environment. However, pip kept its legacy resolver available as a deprecated feature flag. And then there's a list of security fixes at the tail of the article and a note about deprecation of pip constraint. This is to do with a change to pip build constraint. They're making this change to accommodate planned transition to installing build dependencies in process. If you'd like to learn a little more about the build constraint and what's happening there, the previous piece about 26.0 digs into it a lot more. It also includes something that I think is interesting, installing from inline script metadata, the pip 723. 26.0 actually came out in January, I think. This release has pip gain the requirements from script option for installing dependencies declared in inline script metadata. So very useful feature we've been talking a lot about with UV and other tools recently. So pip is continuing to progress, but they have a little bit of a slower schedule. Again, lots of things they need to rely on and make sure still works as far as a legacy of support there. I'm going to have Brett Cannon on the show next week to discuss some of this stuff and also talk about his recent PEPs and a little bit about that virtual environment PEP he was trying to pass that we talked about recently.
Yeah, and just as a reminder, pip supports a configuration file as well. So for flags like uploaded prior to that you might want on all the time, you don't have to remember to constantly put that in. You can stick that in a conf file. And I think it even has like global and local overrides. You can like set it up for particular projects and stuff. So as ungainly as it seems, you could get it to a place where you set it and forget it.
Yeah, you're still using pip primarily, right?
Yep, I still use pip. I still use virtualenv. I still use VI. I'm an old man who is stuck in his ways. Yes.
All right. It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. And it digs into one of the topics we're covering this week. It's titled Working with Python Polars. Polars is a high-performance data frame library designed to provide fast and efficient data processing capabilities and for working with large datasets that might not fit into memory. The course is based on a written tutorial by Harrison Hoffman, and your video instructor is my frequent co-host, Christopher Trudeau. And he takes you through why Polars is so performant and attention-grabbing, how to work with data frames, expressions, and contexts, how to read your data into data frames, how to group and aggregate data, what the lazy API is, and how to build lazy queries. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Well, what do you got next for us here?
My next is a bit of a philosophical journey, kind of a one-hand clapping kind of thing. It's by Luke Plant, who we've featured four or five times before on the show. The title itself is a bit of a mouthful, Inverse Sapir-Whorf and Programming Languages. So if you thought my earlier explanation spiral leading to bad jokes about RAM was rough, well, buckle up, buttercup, it's going to get bumpy. So I'm going to start with Sapir-Whorf. This has nothing to do with programming and is a hypothesis sometimes known as linguistic relativity. The idea actually predates both linguists Edward Sapir and Benjamin Whorf that it's named after. So boys and girls, you too can get something named after yourself, even if you didn't invent it.
Yay!
And my favorite aside is that this is also sometimes known as Whorfanianism, which just has a whole ridges on the forehead kind of sound. But anyways, linguistic relativity is the idea that language determines thought. This is viewed as a constraint, because if you don't have the word for an idea, how could you think about it? Although it's been shown that your native language does influence your perception, this doesn't have as large an effect as the original proposers of the idea thought it would. Now, if you inverse that, that's a different kind of constraint. So instead of focusing on what you can think of because of your language, inverse Sapir-Whorf focuses on ideas you can't express because of your language. An example of this that has actually been proven wrong is that speakers of languages without future tense find quantum physics easier because past and present is irrelevant in quantum physics. This is wrong because even languages without a specific future tense still have ways of describing something happening in the future. So it isn't like those folks are forever stuck in the present and can't think about anything else. That said, an example that Luke uses in the article about something you can't not say in English is how your choice of tense reveals information about you. This can get subtle. Consider the phrase, I'm living in London, versus the phrase, I live in London. Syntactically, they're more or less identical, but the choice of the word living over live implies a temporary situation. You likely aren't considering this when you're answering the question, where do you live? And so your word choice is revealing things about you. Now, I vaguely recall that this is a Python podcast and not a linguistic one, so let's get to the programming part. Huh. So Sapir-Whorf gets mentioned in code in relation to the constraints of a programming language. For example, you kind of have to be vague when talking about memory allocation in Python. It isn't something you do explicitly. In fact, when you declare a list, Python is actually allocating far more memory than you might need, anticipating that you're going to add things to that list. This leads us to the thesis of the article. In fairness to my rambling, it takes Luke halfway through the article to get to the thesis as well, so I'm just keeping the vibe of the article going while talking about it. The whole purpose, of course, is Luke talking about the influence of inverse Sapir-Whorf on coding. His first example is order of execution. Say I have a function that takes two arguments, and I pass in y plus 1 and z plus 2 as my arguments. In Python, y plus 1 gets evaluated first, and the result gets passed as an argument. Then z plus 2 happens, then the function gets called, returning a value. Z is Canadian for Z, for those who are struggling. If you've only ever worked in languages where execution order is specific, it's kind of weird when you encounter one that where it doesn't matter as much. You can't even think about out-of-order execution of function arguments if your native language is Python. Luke mentions that Haskell has non-strict semantics, and that order I just mentioned isn't necessary. This allows you to do some funky things that you just couldn't do in Python, hence our whole inverse Sapir-Whorf thing. Compare static versus dynamically typed languages. There's pros and cons to both, but your choice of language is changing how you think about these things. When you're in one space, the language constraint affects how you approach the problems and what you can and can't think about. The article meanders a little. It doesn't really try to solve any particular problem, and that's why I said at the beginning it's sort of philosophical. A few things do come up along the way. Knowing more languages broadens how you can think about code. Even within Python, which is capable of procedural, object-oriented, and functional programming, knowing when to use each of those mechanisms means you have to think about your paradigm a little differently. The other thesis Luke proposes is an explanation for approachable or readable languages. He suggests the possibility that having a low inverse Sapir-Whorf barrier might contribute to approachability. The less the language forces you to think about a specific thing, like memory allocation, the more approachable it might be. So very much a one hand clapping that no one hears in the woods, tree falling, something or other here. But there's definitely some interesting ideas, you know, worthy of pondering on a lunch break or, you know, over a beer.
I don't know how related this is, but a recent Verge feature is titled Large Language Mistake. Cutting Edge Research Shows Language is Not the Same as Intelligence. The entire AI bubble is built on ignoring it. And I don't know if, you know, it's entirely related, but it has to do with, in this particular case, what expectations have been for large language models and the fact that neuroscience has deduced that human thinking is largely independent of human language.
There's a bias because the vast majority of people have an inner monologue. So for those of us who do, it's assumed that that's what thinking is. There are people who don't, and they're perfectly capable of thinking. So it's where these boundaries are is very, very difficult. And when you start proposing, hey, this X affects Y, and then it turns out people without X can do Y, well, then that kind of blows your thesis away. And here...
Everybody's like me.
It's the natural bias everybody has, right? Like, it's how else do we... Empathy is based on the idea of, well, you must be like what I'm like, right? And it's not necessarily a bad thing. But it's interesting how it impacts how you think about things. And it's both a freedom and a constraint when you're coding based on, you know, the language that you're in.
Yeah, I think it's the relationship you've tied there too with just languages in general and knowing multiple programming languages and their approach, the concepts of dynamic languages like Python, where you can do really wild things with variables and, you know, completely just cast them into new things as you kind of work through it, which is wild.
Yeah, like I've been doing Rust lately, and, you know, I keep hearing Rust is a difficult language. And if you were coming from, you know, Python and JavaScript and TypeScript, yeah, I could see why you would find that challenging. But as a very old C programmer, this just looks like, oh, this is, you know, there's familiarity here. This is like,
kind of thing.
Yeah, this is like C and Rust had C and Python had a baby. And so it's like it got rid of the crunchy parts of C. So having that experience with different languages will make that easier, right?
Yeah.
I find functional programming just mind-blowing, right? I still can't wrap my head around what a monad is, but, you know, maybe I'll get there.
It makes me think of another really bad dad joke. What's a pirate's favorite programming language?
Arr.
You'd think it'd be R, but his true love will always be the sea. Anyway,
what is it with programmers and bad puns?
I don't know. This other person told me that one. I was like, wow, that's pretty good. It was more of a, what is their favorite letter, but in this case, it works two ways. All right. So let's get into projects before this devolves any further. My project this week is titled CAD Query, CAD, Computer Aided Design Scripting Framework. CAD Query I'll just read from the beginning of it. CatQuery is an intuitive, easy-to-use Python library for building parametric 3D CAD models. It has several goals. Their bullet points are build models with scripts that are as close as possible to how you'd describe the object to a human using a standard already established programming language, in this case, Python. Create parametric models that can be very easily customized by end users so you can scale things up or scale them down or just modify individual parameters using code instead of having to do that all with like a mouse and a GUI. Output high-quality CAD formats like STEP, STEP, AMF, 3MF, and additional to the traditional STL, which is what a lot of 3D printer people would be familiar with. And it provides a non-proprietary plain text model format that can be edited and executed with only a web browser. Under the hood, uses something called OCP, which is a C++ wrapper around OCCT on their site for OCCT, Open Cascade Technology, is the only open source full-scale 3D geometry library striving to be one of the best free CAD software kernels. OCCT is widely used for the development of specialized programs in this domain of like 3D printing and other tools. I'm really still wrapping my head around this. I think I haven't moved on from the visual representation in a GUI that having this sort of short set of code is nice and it makes sense, but I'm getting stuck on like, but what is the origin point? How does this hole that you're showing in the middle of this block, how does it know that it's supposed to be at the center? Because very often it doesn't show that in the code. So I'm really intrigued. It has lots of detailed docs, lots of examples of different objects created in this type. And my way in may be using one of these two GUI sort of connections. One is a connection using Qt, right? PyQt. And then the other one is actually working inside of JupyterLab, both of which might continue to help me get my way in there. A couple notes, again, in their explanation of like, why use CADQuery instead of OpenSCAD or SCAD? Like OpenSCAD, CADQuery is an open source script-based parametric model generator, but CADQuery has several key advantages. The scripts use a standard programming language, Python, and thus can benefit from the associated infrastructure, and that includes, you know, not only the standard libraries, but also use inside of an IDE. It has a more powerful CAD kernel. OpenCascade is much more powerful than CGAL, C-G-A-L. It features support for OCC, includes, there's a bunch of weird stuff here, NURBS, N-U-R-B-S, splines, surface sewing, STL repair. I've needed that. Step import, export, other complex operations in addition to the standard CSG operations. Ability to import, export, step, and DXF. These are other formats, again, that might be created in a different CAD package, which is really nice. I think the fact that it supports all these formats is really great for this library. It has less code and easier scripting. Overall, better performance. CADQuery scripts can build the STL, STEP, or AMF, 3MF much faster than OpenSCAD. So I'll note one other tool that's out there. It's called FreeCAD. It's another Python-based tool. It's much more of a full-on GUI, I think, again, using PyQt or PyQt. So yeah, if you're interested in 3D printing like me and exploring things and wondering about the intersection with Python, I think this might be an interesting project for you to check out. All right, what do you got?
My project this week is yet another symptom of how AI is impacting PRs on open source projects. It's by Eric Matthies, and it's called GH Profiler. Eric has been inundated with PRs, many of which aren't worth engaging with. And this isn't a snobbish thing. It isn't that his time is more valuable than yours. It's that Slapapalooza is now a thing. So
this summer.
What GH Profiler does is quickly look up information about you on GitHub. You call it, passing in the name of a GitHub user or a PR or issue number, and it returns info about the associated account. It tells you how old the account is, gives you the user's info like name, email address, that kind of stuff, and any links on their profile, and then summarizes what the user has done on GitHub. The summary includes information about how many PRs the account has opened in the last 21 days, how many issues they've opened, and then gives more info about those issues. It counts how many of the issues were closed as not planned, meaning someone else decided the issues weren't worth dealing with, as well as counts how many of the issues have the same title. As an example, I got a PR request a couple months back to rename one of my RST files as RS because it retook my restructured text doc for a misnamed Rust file without even looking at the contents. This particular PR suggestion was being submitted to a massive number of projects, and of course, each PR had the same name, so this would have caught that. The tool also has an interesting little feature, the redact flag. When set, the output doesn't include the profile name, replacing it with redacted in case you want to demo the tool or copy and paste the results somewhere. Clever little idea that I might steal. It kind of saddens me that AI slop PR requests are the world we live in now, and I hope not too many newbies get their valid PRs rejected because they get lost in the storm. Another approach I saw recently was for one of those orgs that have multiple repos. They set up a honey trap. Any PRs to the trap had to be from bots since there was nothing of value in that repo. And then any account that submitted a PR to the trap went on their ban list and automatically got filtered out of their intake process for the rest of their org. We live in interesting times, and for those who are inundated with requests, tools like GH Profiler could be helpful.
Whack an AI mole.
Yep.
Wow. All right. Well, thanks again for bringing all these releases, news items, articles, and projects again. Thanks again, Chris.
Yeah. And on a personal note, this was episode 101 for me. We missed the anniversary last week. I wasn't paying close enough attention. Time marches on. So
yeah. Congratulations on 101 episodes together.
Yep. Me and the Dalmatians. There we go.
All right. See ya.
Cheers.
Thanks again to 6 Feet Up, the Python and AI experts you call for the hardest software problems. From scaling applications to simplifying data complexity and unlocking AI outcomes, they help you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.